You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey, everybody. It is Trags. And this week on Red Sox Beat, the first one of 2022, I welcome back Chad Jennings of The Athletic. You can follow him on Twitter. He does a great job covering the Red Sox along with Jen McCaffrey. Follow him on Twitter at ChadJennings22, all one word. Chad, thanks for joining me. You wrote a terrific piece this week on The Athletic explaining your vote for the one and only Big Poppy, David Ortiz, for Cooperstown. And you, like me, thought it was pretty much a no-brainer. But what I liked about your story, Chad, is that you did a great job of extrapolating the stats and comparing him with Edgar Martinez of the Seattle Mariners. And I want to get an idea from you why you thought Edgar, already in the Hall of Fame back in 2019, was such a good comp.
Well, I guess it's a comp for me, just because of the Hall of Fame standard, right? You're trying to figure out what makes a Hall of Fame designated hitter. And I think that's tough. And I had decided, you know, look, I can't tell you what the number is that makes me think that he's a Hall of Fame player or whatever, but I felt like Edgar was the guy. I mean, he was before I had a vote, but I would have voted for him. And I think with Ortiz, as I noted in the story, I never really covered it. My first year on the Red Sox, I was covering the Yankees when he was playing. And so my first year on the Red Sox was after he'd left. And I thought he was probably a Hall of Famer, but I also thought, you know, there's a chance that everything else around David, right? Not only the, you know, the postseason success for sure, but also just the personality had maybe inflated the, what we expected of his numbers, right? I thought there's a chance I'd look into his numbers and they were just kind of, you know, good, but I didn't know if they would be Hall of Fame great. And it was amazing to me how much they just almost match up perfectly with Edgar Martinez. I mean, that the, in terms of, they did it differently, right? More power from Ortiz, more kind of on base with Edgar, but to see that in the regular season, that he was Edgar Martinez in the regular season. And then on top of that, he has all the playoff success. And then I also think on top of that, that he is Big Poppy, right? Like, not that just having a big personality and being an iconic like face and name in the game is enough to make you a Hall of Famer, but I think it matters. I mean, the story of baseball in the first 15 years of this century has to include David Ortiz. I mean, he is a vital piece of that. And so you add all that together and then it's an easy vote. But yeah, going into it, I don't know if skeptical is the right word, but I at least thought, you know,
due diligence. Yeah,
right. I'm not going to automatically check the box because there is a chance that somehow the narrative has gotten in the way of facts here. And so I tried to look at the facts and the facts were pretty good.
See, what I like about that, Chad, is the fact that everybody's going to, you know, a lot of fans out there, a lot of Red Sox fans are going to be like, why do you even need to do the research? He's obviously a Hall of Famer.
Right.
That's not the point of the responsibility of owning a vote for the Hall of Fame. And I tell this to people all the time, you know, and I covered the Red Sox, you know, back in Boston for a good 20 years and spoke to many writers about this. And, you know, the point was, when you acquire a vote for the Hall of Fame, it's a responsibility, it's an obligation. And, you know, it's also an honor, right? And you have the opportunity to, you know, put somebody in a hall where those people will be remembered and their memories cherished forever, for as long as there's a sport of baseball. Yeah. And that carries with it certainly a debt of responsibility. And if you're going to handle that responsibility, you have to do your due diligence. That's what I told people.
Yeah. And you know what a wake up call for me was early on, before I had a vote, when I was still in New York, I just sort of threw together one off season, just kind of a breakdown of like the legitimate candidates on the ballot this year. Right. It wasn't a, but anyway, but I didn't even mention Fred McGriff. Just passed him over, because in my head, you know, I wasn't covering McGriff, but I'd seen his career. I know who Fred McGriff is. He not a Hall of Famer, whatever, let's move on. And then I had people call me out. They're like, why didn't you mention Fred McGriff? I'm like, well, I mean, why? So I go back and finally actually looked at his numbers. And I'm not saying he's a Hall of Famer. I haven't done a full dive on whether, but he was damn close. And I mean,
right,
much closer than I realized, or just in my gut instinct. And then, you know, a guy like Tim Raines, I wouldn't have, it took a while of people researching for me to come around and be like, okay, you know what, maybe we didn't appreciate this guy enough. And yeah, I don't know. It just, if you start really looking into it, you find some things that I think can surprise you. And especially there's some guys who just burn really bright for a few years. And maybe that, you know, you go back and start looking at numbers. Chase Utley is a good example. He's coming up. I think I'll vote for Chase Utley. But when he was playing, I was certain he was a Hall of Famer. And as I've gone back and looked at his numbers some, now I'm going to have to research it and figure out, because he's one that kind of goes the other way for me, where I think of him in my head, I thought he was one of the best players I ever saw. And then, but you know, you're going to have to do research on it and figure out for sure.
So what's interesting about Chase Utley to me is he's one of those players that identifies an organization, and he was one of the best Phillies ever, certainly at that position. And you get into the kind of the argument, I think, when you have a player of that ilk who definitely is an iconic member of the franchise, of the Philadelphia Phillies. But right, does that translate into him being one of the most dominant players of the era? To me, that's a great conversation to have.
Yeah.
Kind of like the Poppy conversation, but yeah. I think Poppy's numbers are even more significant. But go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. I also like, at least I've found in, once I became a voter, there is comfort in the numbers that it takes, that I'm, for someone to get in, I'm one of 300 votes that player needs to get. So my opinion's not right. Your opinion's not right. We're taking a bunch of people who hopefully are all taking this seriously. And we're all going to kind of come at it from our own perspectives and have our own little things we weigh more or less. And then there has to be this massive consensus to get someone in. And so I think that, you know, for example, that's led me to, I vote for Bobby Abreu, because I kind of lump him in with some of these other players who I feel like, you know, maybe I look at his numbers that are much closer to Tony Gwynn and Dave Winfield than I would have expected. And you just think, man, I could see in a few years that we could come to better appreciate this guy. And I think he might be a Hall of Famer. And it takes me and 300 other people to agree with me, right? Like, I'm not saying, I don't get to rubber stamp it and say he's a Hall of Famer, but I could say, yeah, I'll put my, not even 2 cents behind him, my half of a cent in, and say I'm okay with that. So I don't know. I think that's all part. You hope that there are a lot of people all doing this sort of thought about it. And that doesn't necessarily mean right or wrong. I mean, people come back and will say, well, what about this argument? What about that argument? Well, yeah. No, I mean, a lot of times those are perfectly valid arguments. It's just, you know, I kind of maybe land on just this other side of it. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think you just do your best to wrap your head around it, because it's a very imprecise thing, right? I mean,
right,
a handful of people, it's like just obviously that's, it's in. But even for the guys you vote for, a lot of times there are issues there or whatever that make it where you could question that.
I'm going to get to your full ballot in just a moment. But basically you wrote, if he was not Big Poppy, if he were just some guy named David, would he be a lock for Cooperstown? Turns out, yes, he would. To me, that was very, very interesting. Why did you kind of take it from that perspective?
Because I think that the only way, well, look, I mean, unless you're going to buy, unless it's the steroids thing, right? The 2003 test, unless that's your holdup, then I think the hangup has to be either you're just thinking a DH shouldn't go into the Hall of Fame, which, okay, I disagree with that. I guess I could see he should play both sides, whatever. But otherwise, you're just saying you think that the myth of Big Poppy is bigger than what he actually was. And
right.
And so, okay, strip that away. And again, like I say, when I take that away, I find just a performance in the regular season that is Edgar Martinez. And you got Edgar Martinez in the regular season. And then on top of that, you add all of the Big Poppiness, right? Everything that happened in October, winning rings, this is our effing city. You take all of that stuff and put it on top of Edgar Martinez. Now we've got, I mean, what I think is was a very easy vote in the end.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, your point about you can't tell the story without the player is a brilliant one. And I think it, you know, really that kind of quantifies to me, Chad Jennings, or qualifies to me what people talk about when they say, if you see, you know, a Hall of Famer, if you see it, if you have to make any argument for him, he's not a Hall of Famer. Well, with David Ortiz, once you take the whole picture into account with David Ortiz, I don't think there's any doubt. And, you know, I think, you know, his stature at the beginning of his career to the, you know, this is our effing city in 2013, you know, and all of the stuff he did toward the end of his career, he was just so consistent for such a long period of time. To me, it was a no-brainer. I do want to address your full ballot here. And the other names besides David Ortiz, Bobby Abreu, which you have mentioned, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Todd Helton, Andrew Jones, Scott Rowland, Gary Sheffield, Sammy Sosa, Billy Wagner. So with Bonds, Clemens, and Sosa, why did you put them on there?
I've come to think that the steroid era was a failure of everyone. Right? It was allowed to happen in my mind. That's not to say they weren't cheating the game. That's not to say that there weren't moral and ethical lines crossed here, but the league and the Players Association let it happen. I mean, they knew what was going on. I cannot look at this and go, well, they were cheating, but in a sport that was allowing them to do so and celebrating them for doing so, and now retroactively say, well, you tarnished the game. Well, the game was tarnished. The game was letting itself be tarnished along the way. And then I draw a line between, okay, then the league figures out what's going on here and decides that it's too ugly, and they try to clean it up. And then when you have players like, I don't vote for Alex Rodriguez or Manny Ramirez, who are still violating the rules at that point, when the league is actually now saying, okay, no, now we're going to enforce this. That's the line I draw.
That's a fair line to me.
It just also keeps me from guessing, right? I really dislike the argument that Barry Bonds was a Hall of Famer before he used steroids. Like, I just think now we're trying to guess about things that I don't think we possibly know.
Right.
In the same, like, okay, well, if he hadn't used it, what would his number?
It's impossible to project that.
That's what I think. And so I'm trying to leave myself out of it a little bit and just go, okay, who was doing something when the league was saying it's illegal? The league, there's a long history of this with the league. I mean, we just saw it where the league finally this last season decides pitchers can't use the same sticky stuff they've been using.
Right.
Well, this wasn't some big secret. Everyone in baseball knew these guys were using stuff. So are you going to now go, well, Gerrit Cole, we have to dismiss everything he did before because he was using sticky stuff was technically illegal. Well, the league was letting him do it. Everyone knew this was happening. And
right.
So I don't, it's obviously a bigger issue with steroids, but that's sort of where I land on it. That's why I vote for those guys, is that they come from an era when we can say it wasn't allowed by the rules, but it was allowed. I mean, baseball loves talking about its unwritten rules and how it polices itself and all this stuff. Well, if that's the case, well, your unwritten rule in 2001 was use whatever you want. Just hit home runs and throw more fastballs, right? Like, so I just can't, I don't want to retroactively judge those guys based on my own moral standard when the era in which they played, that was the standard.
I'm fascinated to see whether or not any of those three beyond Ortiz get into the Hall of Fame this year. If you had to guess, what do you think?
Guess no. I would guess no way. Yeah, I don't think so. No. And then at that point, you wonder, will they ever, right? I mean,
right.
Bonds and Clemens don't get in with the voters. Is a veterans committee going to vote those guys in? No way.
No.
I wouldn't think. I mean, so, you know, but I also maybe that's fine. I don't know. We talk about this as if like, well, if he's not in the Hall of Fame, we're going to forget about Barry Bonds. Hey, what? I mean, we haven't forgotten about Pete Rose. Like, it's okay. I mean, I would hope that because it's also a museum and Cooperstown is great and it does such a good job. I mean, but there's no harm in also having in there an exhibit about the steroid era that points out Clemens and Bonds and A-Rod and McGuire and Manny and whoever. It says, look, these were some of the great players of their era. They were not voted into the Hall of Fame because of these issues. But, you know, you don't have to be in the Hall of Fame to be remembered in baseball. You know, it's okay. Again, I vote for Bonds and Clemens to go in. If they don't, that doesn't mean I don't get to tell my kids how great Bonds and Clemens were, right? And try to explain to them some of the, you know, other things you have to wrestle with about their careers.
Speaking with Chad Jennings of The Athletic, doing a great job covering the Red Sox for The Athletic. Follow him on Twitter at ChadJennings22, all one word. BetOnline has you covered in 2022 with more props, odds, and lines than ever before as football continues its march through the College Bowl seasons and the upcoming College Football Playoff Championship this coming Monday, and the Pro Football Playoffs, of course, as well through January and early February. BetOnline remains your number one spot for all of the sports action this winter. Head to the website, or you can use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use our promo code CLNS50 to receive your bonus. From basketball, football, NHL, boxing, and UFC, right to your very favorite Vegas casino games, don't wait to take advantage of all of the amazing offers now available. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet all of your favorite sports, so don't wait to take advantage of all of the new amazing offers now available. BetOnline, where the game starts. Well, I think we'd be remiss, Chad Jennings, if we didn't mention the passing of somebody who is very near and was very near and dear to a lot of people in Red Sox Nation, and that was the passing of Jim Corsi. Earlier this week at the age of 60 at his home in Bellingham. He passed away today on Tuesday, January 4th, as we record this. And, you know, I just want to get your perspective. I know you did not know him personally, but when so many people talk about what a guy meant in and around the organization, like Jim Corsi did to the Red Sox, and what kind of person he was, and the attention at the end of his life. Steve Burton of WBZ Channel 4 did an incredible interview, and anybody who has the ability to go online and search for the interview Steve Burton did with Jim Corsi should absolutely do that if you haven't seen it by now. Just your thoughts on the passing of Jim Corsi and somebody, you know, who won a World Series ring with the Oakland A's.
Well, it's interesting for me. He's just I just remember him right from baseball cards. So that's he pitched in an era as I was coming up to, you know, following baseball. Right. And certainly not cover him. But it's interesting that guys like that, you know, especially I grew up, I was a Cardinals fan. So I wasn't, you know, I mean, obviously I knew the A's because they were just huge at the time, but they all just kind of get mixed in, right? He's just one of the pitchers there and all this. And then it's not until later, at least for me, that you start to discover the impact some of these guys have. And now being around the game, you recognize the impact of those guys more and more, right? Guys who are, you know, maybe seem like a secondary piece of a roster, but in reality, when you've been in the clubhouse, you know how important that guy is,
yep,
both to the team and just throughout the organization. And I just think it's great when, you know, it's obviously, I mean, look, it's horribly sad. I think Jim was 60. I mean, that's, you know, unbelievably too early. But it's interesting when moments like this happen, and I think people like that get to be celebrated for the bigger things that they were beyond just, oh, he was a good pitcher for whatever 10 years in the big leagues. I think that's nice, because that's stuff that I didn't know. I didn't have any real sense of that what Jim Corsi was like as a player off the field. So it's, you know, it's both devastatingly sad to hear about, but also, I don't know, in its own way, sort of uplifting. I think that you get to celebrate the full measure of the person and not just the numbers on the page.
Well, that's just it. And I think that's a great point, Chad, is that too often, I think, you know, in baseball, certainly you could say that there is a heavy, heavy influence of the numbers and the metrics used to measure baseball, all about the numbers. And then I ran into Jim Corsi many times in the clubhouse. All I can tell you, Chad, is that the guy always had a smile on his face when you said hi to him. It wasn't just, hey, how you doing? His face would light up if he recognized you, or even if he really didn't, if he knew who you were but didn't really know you, he would still give you a genuine smile and make you feel warm. And I think too often today in the sports world, and you know, now we don't even get in any sport really with the pandemic, we don't get to go into the locker room and interact with these players and these athletes and get to really know them. But he allowed you to get to know him, and he wanted to know who you were. And to me, that's why, you know, when a guy like Jim Corsi leaves us, that's kind of what crosses my mind, is you miss the person. You don't miss the athlete as much.
Oh, sure. And I mean, and, you know, Jim Corsi could pass through without much recognition, right? I mean, a late inning reliever, you know, the reason that he's being talked about today is because he had that other impact, right? I mean,
yes,
it's not that he had a good career, but it's just, he didn't have the career that's going to stand out and expect for you to see like tributes to the guy written or on television or whatever. But it's because of the other things that he brought that's really the legacy he's left, right? Like a very good big league reliever who also had a personality that went beyond that. And it's interesting that's what gets to be celebrated.
Yeah, he also, by the way, did win a World Series ring with the Florida Marlins. He was part of the expansion Florida Marlins in 1993. I was thinking 2003 when the Florida Marlins won their second World Series. But no, he did win a World Series with the 1989 Oakland A's. Rest in peace, Jim Corsi. Now, speaking with Chad Jennings, I want to get to your Red Sox organizational depth chart and some of the positions that stuck out to me. We'll start first, and we'll make it quick because I know we don't have all the time in the world here. Catcher, what do you think the Red Sox do behind Christian Vasquez and Connor Wong, who many Red Sox fans already very familiar with him. He's been up a couple of times. What is the potential of him moving up the depth chart and eventually becoming the number one catcher on the Red Sox system?
I guess it's possible. I don't know. What's interesting is right now they went ahead and brought back Plawecki. You know, I guess they could have non-tendered him. He's not overly expensive, but just with Vasquez being a free agent at the end of the year, I would wonder if there was any thought or desire to, even though he's worth it, to non-tender Plawecki just to open that role for Wong, so that you could get his feet wet, get him ready, see if he could handle big league pitching in case you have to use him in 2023. And, you know, look, maybe that could still happen. I mean, maybe they're going to try to trade Plawecki and open up that job. But it is interesting. Back in November, we started hearing that the Red Sox were at least talking to different people about catchers. And there were reports out then that they'd approached the Pirates about trading for Stallings, their young catcher. To me, that may be a condemnation of Vasquez, who didn't have a great year. But I also think more than that, it's just, you know, we've talked about that Heim Bloom's always thinking about the future. And
yep.
I don't think you can expect him to look at this and go, both of my catchers are free agents at the end of this season, and think that he's not going to at least look into, is there a way to proactively address that? that it makes total sense that he may not be able to do that. He might just have to kind of ride this out for a year and then figure out what to do with the catching situation next winter. But I wouldn't be shocked, and I'm not surprised now to know that they've looked into the idea of making some sort of move that gives them a, if not a super long-term like catcher of the ultimate future, but at least somebody who has some more years of control and some big league experience who leave you where you're not just completely bare at the end of this coming season behind the plate. Cause again, if Colton Wong is sort of the third catcher again this year and just gets a handful of innings, I don't think that that's going to be enough where you feel like, okay, let's go ahead and hand him the reins in 2023. I think catcher is an interesting spot because it's very set right now. I mean, they have four guys on the 40-man roster. I mean, they have two guys on the big leagues and plenty of depth, but it's still a position that could see some turnover just because they've got to prepare for beyond this season.
All right, first base, Bobby Dalbec, Tristan Casas, Kyle Schwarber. It's a fascinating position to me because of what Bobby Dalbec showed in the second half of the season, which was tremendous power. I thought he became a better hitter. He might be a viable option there, or he could play the other corner position. What do you think about first base and third base, if you want to throw that in there?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that they could, you know, look, if they bring back Schwarber, I think you could play Schwarber in left, right, primarily,
mm-hmm.
put Verdugo in right, and then you kind of could mix and match a little bit, right? You could play some matchups, a tough right-hander. You could sit Dalbec, play Schwarber at first, play Jackie in the outfield now that you have him. You know, you could change some things around if you have Schwarber. If you don't, you get somebody else. I still think there's a chance that they just open the year with Dalbec as the guy, and you could go get, you know, like a Brad Miller type or something, like a more utility type guy to kind of share some time there for the time being while you wait for Casas. But I also think that, you know, you mentioned third base as a part of this conversation. And another thing I think that's worth at least thinking about is right now, if obviously Devers is the guy, right? They're not going to fool around there. They're not moving Devers to DH while JD's here. They're not moving in first, but Devers is the guy at third. But if Devers gets hurt and has to miss a month, who else is going to play third? I think right now, if Devers gets hurt, your third baseman's Bobby Dalbec.
I would agree with that.
Find someone else to stick at first, right? So there's that added value that Dalbec brings, even though most days his ability to play third is a non-issue because third base is filled. But the fact that he can do it gives you a little bit of insurance at third base, and I think also adds some value to him in the short term for the Red Sox. So yeah, I it's an interesting position because they Dalbec had a good second half, rough first half, defense wasn't great. But how much are you really going to invest in first base when arguably the best first base prospect in baseball is sitting in AAA, you know, potentially 2 months away.
So is he on the regular roster coming out of spring training? If the Red Sox had their druthers, would Tristan Casas make it?
No, I don't think so. Because I think they want him to play AAA. One thing that Casas has, I think everyone universally agrees, he has tremendous power potential. He could be a 30, 40 homer guy, but he's never slugged 500 in the minor leagues. Now, I think then you see what he does like in the Olympics, right? He plays five games, hits three home runs, all three of them go ahead homers. I think it's there, and I think they think it's there, but that he is a smart enough young player and a confident enough young player that he has spent the minor leagues honing his hitting, right? He has a legit two-strike approach. He can go up the middle. He has never once tried to just sell out for power and show everyone that he can hit massive home runs. I think that's just in there. And I think there's a chance when he gets to a stage when he needs it, he's going to be that guy. But I think you still want to see it. And I think you still want him to go back to AAA, get some time. You know, I mean, he's pretty young and mixed in here is a whole minor league season that was lost, right? I mean, it's not the worst for him to get a little bit more development time, especially in AAA. And then especially when Haim Bloom has talked about that he thinks AAA is a vital step for these guys. You know, in the past under Dombrowski, you know, Devers basically skipped AAA. Benintendi basically skipped AAA. I don't know that we're going to see that very much under Haim, because he has talked about that he thinks AAA is a vital step along the way. And so I don't think there's much of any chance that Cassis makes the team out of spring training. Is that a different story on June 1st? I think it could be.
So under Haim Bloom, we've seen that the second baseman can play center field and a center fielder can play second base. You know where I'm going with this. What are they going to do with Jeter Downs? And I assume that Christian Arroyo, even though he is projected right now as the current starter at second base, I just don't get the sense that is going to be the case come early April. But correct me if I'm wrong, Chad.
Yeah, I think at best Arroyo is a part of the second base solution, right? I don't know that they necessarily go out and get that they sign Trevor Story to a 1-year Marcus Semien contract and hope that he agrees. But I mean, it's possible, but I just don't know that. I don't know that I'd put that as like the most likely thing. I think there's a decent chance that what they do is go out and get, you know, another utility type guy. And now, especially with Jackie now on the roster again, you know, now you can play Hernandez at second and play Jackie in center against right-handers in particular. And, you know, there it gives you some more options. But yeah, I think that, so I don't know that they're going to make a massive investment in second base, which means I think you could still have Arroyo as sort of a piece of that puzzle. I don't think they're just going to, he's going to be the only second baseman on the roster come opening day. But then, yeah, the guy behind him, I mean, there's still a lot of hope for Jeter Downs. You know, his minor league development has been sort of strange. I mean, he was pushed a lot early as a very young player. And then obviously has the missed season. He gets traded over. Loses the season to the pandemic, has to jump to AAA and had just a pretty brutal season in AAA, but he's still young enough and there's still enough stuff in there that I think they still think that this guy might be their long-term second baseman. He's going to have to show it this year to sort of get on that map.
As you point out, Xander Bogaerts, even though his defensive metrics aren't great, aren't eye popping, he has the bat. He's going to be your shortstop. And, you know, I don't know how signing Carlos Correa would impact that. You don't like the idea, do you, necessarily, of moving Xander around and putting Carlos Correa at shortstop, or do you?
I mean, I don't know. I don't hate it, but I also don't know if that's the best use of your resources. It might be. I mean, you know, look, you're going to have to make a decision at some point here. I mean, Xander's going to opt out after this season. Yeah. Right. You look at the amount of money that other guys are making, there's no sense in him staying on this deal. So you got to figure out some sort of solution at second or at short. Because Marcelo Mayer, the first top pick this year, he's certainly not going to be ready now, or
he's only 19.
4 years. Yeah. So you've got to fill this gap somehow. You know, I mean, you could do that and move Xander over, but I also think, I don't know, that's a big commitment. I mean, Correa is a great player. But I think Xander, you know, I mean, Xander's one of those, like we were just talking about, good clubhouse guys who's nice and smiles at you. I think Xander would be open to doing that if he recognizes it's for that kind of player. But again, is that the best use of their resources? I don't know. You know, I think they would probably like to just sign Xander, you know, to some sort of an extension. And I think maybe that's a better way to go. But that's the only thing I could see change in the shortstop position in the short term, is if they were to just make the massive investment in Correa and move Xander over to second. But I don't, right now, that doesn't feel like the most likely way we're going. I think you've got one more year of Xander, and they try to figure out an extension or rework his contract in some way. And you kind of kick the can down the road a little bit to, at some point, Xander's probably going to have to move to either second or third, but I don't think that necessarily has to be right now.
Well, we just touched on the outfielders, so we didn't even get to the starting rotation and the bullpen. And I'm going to leave that to our listeners to go look at The Athletic. That's what's called a major league tease there, Chad Jennings. want everybody to go to The Athletic and get a full rundown of the entire Red Sox organizational depth chart. Chad does a tremendous job breaking it all down. It is about 5 to 6 pages long, and everything you want to know about what's going on in the Red Sox organization, Chad Jennings really does lay it out for you. Chad, I want to thank you for joining me here on the Red Sox Beat. I want to wish you a happy 2022, and I'm sure you're like everybody else. Hopefully we're writing baseball in 2 months and not CBA talk, because I tried reading it today on The Athletic, the mailbag section about the biggest questions. I had an ice cream freeze. I just couldn't deal with it. I really couldn't. So I'm just praying to God that we're talking baseball in 2 months. You think so?
Man, what makes me nervous is the ultimate leverage comes down to when we're closer, right?
Yeah.
Going to put this thing off until, mid-February, right? It was everybody's supposed to be reporting to camp and try to light a fire under both sides. And then, so maybe we help, get an agreement at March 1st or something and try to have an expedited spring training. So I don't know. I am mentally preparing myself for, 2 more months of this whole thing.
Yes. Well, I want to thank everybody for downloading today's podcast. Thank our terrific guest, Chad Jennings, covering the Red Sox for The Athletic. Please do follow him on Twitter at ChadJennings22. Also want to thank our great sponsor, as always, betonline.ag. For Chad Jennings, I'm Mike Petralia, and this has been the Red Sox Beat Podcast, powered by CLNS Media.